All right, now on slide two, this is just a picture to introduce a new concept. We're looking at close-ups of Drosophila eyes. Drosophila is a genus of fruit flies. They're used often in genetics experiments. There's actually many different eye colors that fruit flies can have, but for the gene that we're interested in this one, there are these two traits. The wild type is this red, kind of brick red color, and white is a mutant. What's different about this, though, as we go to slide three to explain it, is that unlike all the other characteristics that we've talked about so far, this is a characteristic that is not controlled by a gene on an autosome. Now, what does auto mean?
Self.
Yes. So autosomes are chromosomes, but they are all the chromosomes except for what we call sex chromosomes in species that have such things, which fruit flies do. So the entire genome, which is all the DNA in an organism, comes in two categories of chromosomes: autosomes, which are most of the chromosomes, and then sex chromosomes. Works the same way in mammals, including, of course, humans. So if you think back to the karyotype that we looked at, which was for humans in that case, remember there were 23 pairs of chromosomes because that's N is 23 for humans. Well, pairs 1 through 22 are the autosomes in humans. And even though it's pair number 23, we don't call it number 23. We call it the sex chromosome pair, which there's two types of, X and Y. Now, the reason that we make the distinction between autosomes and sex chromosomes is because sex chromosomes are not truly homologous to each other. The two sex chromosomes that a diploid individual has, that is, are not truly homologous. Think about what it means to be truly homologous, like the two number ones or the two number 15s or whatever. What does that actually mean to be homologous? Same what, though? They're not exactly the same, right? They're not identical. But what is the same about them? Two homologs. Yeah, we're talking about a homologous pair. What's the same about those two homologs?
The same type of chromosome?
Yeah, that's another way of saying they're homologous, but what makes them the same type of chromosome? Not only the same number of loci, but therefore same number of genes, right, which are occupying those loci. And even more than that, it's not just that they happen to have the same number of genes. They are the same types of genes, right? Remember that genes correspond to what? What did I say? A gene corresponds to... Not a trait, no. A characteristic. An allele corresponds to a trait. There's multiple possible alleles for that one gene that you're talking about, right? And that's why you can have two different alleles if you're a diploid, because you have an allele for that gene on one chromosome and an allele on that gene for the other homolog of that chromosome. Now, a different chromosome, say they're both on number two, the number three chromosome has a completely different set of genes controlling a completely different set of characteristics. Okay? That's what it means to be homologous. They're the same size, have the same genes on them. Not necessarily the same alleles for those genes, but the same genes governing the same set of categories, characteristics. Okay, now, for the autosomes, however many there are for the species, they are truly homologous, based on what I just said. That means every gene that's on an autosome, a diploid individual is going to have two of those, because the other homolog of that autosome has all of the genes that the first homolog does. That's what it means to be truly homologous. That's not true for sex chromosomes. Sex chromosomes get their name because they have genes that are important for the development of sex, whether it's male or female, during development. Okay, so that's why they're called sex chromosomes. But it's not true that every gene that's on sex chromosomes has anything to do with sex. There are other genes as well. All right, so they're called sex chromosomes because of that. But they govern a lot more than just what sex the individual is going to be. And since they're not truly homologous, that means that there's one version of a sex chromosome that has more genes than the other homolog does. Like X and Y are the names of the two homologs in humans, and actually in fruit flies as well. Obviously, they're not the same chromosome for fruit flies, but they're given the same names, X and Y. And just like in humans, the X chromosome of fruit flies is much bigger than the Y chromosome. And by being bigger, that means it contains genes, the X chromosome contains genes that the Y chromosome doesn't have. There aren't corresponding loci for those genes on the Y chromosome because it's just not as big. All right? So autosomes are called autosomes because auto means self, as you said, and they are really about the individual. The sex chromosomes are somewhat about that individual, of course, but they also are what determine if that individual procreates or passes on its genes by reproducing. That chromosome is going to be involved in determining the sex of the offspring. That's why they're called that. Which is more than just about the self, right? It's about the next generation as well. Okay, now, on slide 3 at the top, we can see a cross between two individuals. And this is a, what kind of cross? How would you classify this? What are the possibilities? What are the possibilities for the types of crosses? I'm asking what kind of cross this is. Well, what have we talked about as far as crosses are concerned?
Monohybrid.
Right, monohybrid is one possibility. Mm-hmm. Dihybrid is another possibility, right? We also talked about test cross. Well, this is a monohybrid cross, but why is it a monohybrid cross? What does that mean? One characteristic is all we care about. That's the mono part. Why is it a monohybrid cross?
Because it's mating two breed parents having different traits from one of another.
Right, for that one characteristic that we care about, the two parents have different traits for that characteristic. It's not a red eye mated with another red eye here. It's a red eye and a white eye. Now remember that on all the other crosses, we just said one parent has this trait or these traits, and the other parent has this trait or these traits. We didn't care about which one was the male and which one was the female. Because if it is a characteristic that is autosomal, meaning governed by a gene that's on an autosome rather than a sex chromosome, it doesn't matter. The math works out exactly the same, right? And Punnett squares that we generated for those earlier crosses told you how many, as a fraction or a percentage, of the offspring should be this genotype or that genotype, but it didn't tell you at all whether they were going to be male or female, right? Because it didn't matter. Now we're paying attention to sex because this eye color gene that we're looking at is not autosomal. The locus that this gene resides at is on the X chromosome in these flies. Doesn't have anything to do with sex, but it's on the X chromosome that has other genes having to do with sex. Okay? But it also happens to be on part of the X chromosome for which there isn't a corresponding part on the Y chromosome. So that's why there's only one allele in an organ in a fly that has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome, which we know of as a male. You know, that's how the sex chromosomes operate for sex determination, which is nothing to do with his eye color. An individual that gets an X from both parents, an XX individual, is going to be a female. An individual that gets an X from one parent and a Y from the other parent is going to be a male. Males are XY. And therefore, for any so-called sex-linked gene, there's only one allele in a male for each cell, right? Whereas in a female, there are two alleles because she is an XX. So she'll have two alleles just like in all the autosomes, right? A female actually has truly homologous sex chromosomes. A male has one that isn't homologous to the other because they're not the same size. They have different numbers of genes. Well, we can see this eventually when we get down to looking at the chromosomes in this cartoon, but let's start from the top here and look at the cross. Since since this is a sex-linked characteristic, we're paying attention to the gender. So this is the symbol for female, this is the symbol for male. The female is the wild-type, red-eyed individual. And even though her her genotype isn't shown, she's true breeding. So she has two alleles, right? And therefore, she could have a genotype that would look just like it would for an autosome. He is a white-eyed individual, but whereas females can be described as being one of the three main categories that we've already talked about, meaning homozygous dominant, heterozygous, or homozygous recessive, that doesn't apply to a male, right? Homozygous dominant, for instance, means both of your two alleles are the same and they're both dominant, right? Well, that doesn't describe a male because a male doesn't have two alleles if it's a sex-linked gene. So we don't use those words for males when we're talking about a sex-linked characteristic. Instead, we call males hemizygous because hemi means half. All right? Hemizygous because a male has only half as many alleles as the female does for any of those genes. He has one where she has two. So notice that this also affects how dominance works. If you only have one, then you're going to have the trait that that allele corresponds to because that's the only one you have, right? And so his only eye color allele on the X chromosome is the white version, and therefore he's white-eyed. But white, if you have two alleles, like a female can, is recessive to red. Okay? A male is just going to have whatever trait his one allele will dictate, though. All right, now, this looks like it's just like any other cross we've looked at before. You have a dominant trait, which is red, and a recessive trait, which is white. And therefore, when you have a monohybrid cross, you expect all of the F1s to be the dominant phenotype, right? That's exactly what happened here. F1s are all wild-type red-eyed. So it seems like it's the same. It's not, though. It really even seems like it's the same when you get down to the F2, because what you learned for autosomes is that if you then interbreed the F1s to produce the F2, that means you're really crossing two heterozygotes, right? Because all the F1s are heterozygous in an autosomal case. And therefore, you'd expect that 3-to-1 ratio, right, that we talked about. Well, it's not true, though, in a sex-linked case, that the F1s are all heterozygous. All the females are heterozygous, because that word applies to only to individuals that have two alleles, right? The males in the F1 do not have two alleles. Males, by definition, have one. So all the males in the F1 are hemizygous, red-eyed. All the females are heterozygous. And therefore, 100% of the offspring in the F1 are red-eyed. So it looks the same, but it's different. And then in the F2, it's not the case that it's 3/4 of the offspring are red and 1/4 are white, like it is in the autosomal case. In the autosomal case, we say it's 3-to-1 ratio. That means 75% of the males are expected to be dominant, and 25% are expected to be recessive, and the same for females. It's not what's happening here. So let's look at it under the box that says conclusion by paying attention to what's happening at the chromosome level. Notice that the female has two X chromosomes. That's by definition what made her female. Okay? So this is really just like the autosomal case. She has two alleles. And they can be the same as each other, homozygous, or different, heterozygous. Well, I told you she was a true breeder, so this is back to the original P generation, by the way. So this is just like it would be for an autosome. The male, on the other hand, has an X and a Y. That's what makes him male. And the Y chromosome, this curved one, does not have the eye color gene on it. That's why he's hemizygous, because he has only one allele. And since he has the white allele, that gives him white eyes. Okay, when you draw the Punnett square, which, remember, represents what? What does the Punnett square represent? Not the whole square. I mean, the whole square represents what process? Process. What did you say?
Zygote.
Process. A zygote is a thing.
The test cross?
No, not necessarily. You can have a Punnett square for any kind of cross. What process does the Punnett square actually represent? Something that's happening is what I mean by process. What is the hallmark of sex?
Fertilization.
Yes, that's what a Punnett square represents, fertilization, right? It represents all the possible fertilization possibilities when all you care about is that one characteristic that these two particular parents can come up with, right? And remember what fertilization is. Well, tell me what it is. What is fertilization? Yeah, you fuse two gametes to produce a zygote. That's the definition of fertilization. That's what the box is representing, because you put you list all possible gametes that one parent can make for that characteristic, all possible gametes along the other side of the box that the other parent can make for that one characteristic, and therefore you match up every possible egg and sperm. That's why it's an exhaustive list of all the possible zygotes that those two particular parents can produce via fertilization. Well, notice it's only one row here, and that's because the female is true breeding. Right? She's going to make eggs, but since she's homozygous dominant, it doesn't matter which one you choose, you're going to get a red allele. By the way, red is represented as W plus. This is yet another standard that they use for the genotypes. Here you use the initial that stands for the mutant form, the recessive form, instead of the dominant. But if it's actually dominant instead of recessive, you put a plus superscript. So W plus actually means red, even though the W is for white. And truly, white is a W just by itself. Okay, so it doesn't matter which one of these W pluses or red alleles you pick from the female, you're going to get a red egg, and therefore that's why that's only one genotype, one gamete that's listed for her. He, on the other hand, can produce two different kinds of sperm. If the X is chosen, it's going to carry a white allele. If the Y is chosen, then the sperm is not going to pass on any allele for that characteristic. But notice that it also, since X and Y, the sex chromosomes, determine gender in the offspring, it's also going to affect the ratios in males differently from the ratio in females of the phenotypes. And we can see this in the Punnett square. If her X egg gets matched up with an X sperm from him, you're going to make an XX individual, which by definition is a female. That's why this box, unlike the ones for autosomes, actually lists the gender. Okay, that's a female, and she is going to be heterozygous. Every female will be heterozygous, right? Because there's only one way to make a female, to get X and X together. On the other hand, if a Y sperm happens to be randomly chosen during the fertilization, then you're getting her X egg and a Y sperm together to make an XY individual, which by definition is a male. And when that happens, since the Y that he contributed does not give any allele to the offspring, that offspring will not only be a male, it will be a red-eyed male because he got the allele from the mother. Right? Any male would have to get the allele for a sex-linked gene from the mother. Because if he's male, he has a Y, he can only get a Y from a male because only males have Ys. It has to be his father that gave it to him. Alright? Okay, so this explains what looks like the same results as an autosome, but it happened differently. Yes, you do have all of the F1 having red eyes, but in a different way from the autosomal case. You have all of them, all of the females being heterozygous and therefore red-eyed, and all of the males being homozygous but red-eyed. So they're all red-eyed, but for different reasons. Now you cross those. And here you have a four-box Punnett square because now the females in the F1, since they're heterozygous, can make two different kinds of eggs. Any egg they're going to make will carry the X chromosome, but it will be one X chromosome or the other that she has. So she can pass on a white allele egg or a red allele egg. He, on the other hand, or a male from the F1, is still homozygous, but homozygous red now, not white. Okay, so he can pass on a Y chromosome that doesn't have any eye color gene he can pass a red X, red colored X, or a no color Y. And therefore, you have the results that, once again, look like the results in an autosomal case for F2. They have the same overall ratio, but for a different reason. Notice that 100% of the females are red-eyed. Half of them are homozygous dominant, which, of course, is going to make them red-eyed. The other half of them are heterozygous and red-eyed. So they're indistinguishable phenotypically, unless you actually look at the genes. On the other hand, one half of the males, however many there are, should be red-eyed, and the other half should be white-eyed. So that's a different way of having things happen compared to the autosomal case. Now, we call this either sex-linkedness. We call the gene a sex-linked gene. Sometimes you see the phrase X-linked, which it means the same thing as long as you're talking about a species that has X and Y chromosomes. Not all sex chromosomes are called X and Y. But X-linked and sex-linked mean the same thing for humans, because we have X and Y chromosomes, and so do flies. Not all insects, but these flies do. All right, let's go to 3. To 4. We've already done 3. This is just a photomicrograph of X and Y chromosomes. And you can see X is much bigger. So there are some genes that are on both. But the vast majority of the genes carried by the X do not occur at all on the Y, because there just isn't a corresponding part of the chromosome there. Now in 5, this is not an exhaustive list by any means. This is just showing you some examples of sex determination mechanisms in certain species. These all happen to be animals, but like I said, it's just a sprinkling of the possibilities. Humans are used for the XY system as an example, but that's actually true for all mammals. We all use the XY system. And notice the genotypes that are listed here. 44 plus XY, 44 plus XX. What's the 44 refer to? More specifically. No, not genes. There are thousands of genes. Right. The 44 represents the 22 pairs of autosomes. Remember that N for humans is 23. Therefore, there are 22 autosomes and a pair of sex chromosomes. The 22 pairs of autosomes make a total of 44 chromosomes, right? 44 autosomes overall, 22 homologous pairs. And then you have two sex chromosomes, which is either X and Y or X and X in the normal cases. So in the XY system that humans use, that mammals use, XY, like I said, results in maleness. Now that is the genetic requirement for becoming a male, but that is not enough. It's not sufficient for you to have an X and Y to become a male, because that just is going to determine the kinds of hormones that are made early on in development. We all start out the same, sexless. And then we develop into a male or a female based on which hormones are present during that early development, which in turn depends on the genes. But things can go wrong. So even just because you are XY does not mean you will develop into a normal male. And the same for XX. But under normal circumstances, XY becomes male, XX becomes female. So these are both diploid representations, as you'd expect for humans, right? 44 plus XY is a diploid description of the genome of that human. 22X, 22Y, those are haploid representations, right? Representing his sperm, his possible sperm. She can only make one kind of egg, though, because she has two X chromosomes. It doesn't matter which one you pick, it's going to be an X egg. That's why only one egg is listed, 22 plus X. Okay, now, not only does it mean that XY is going to become male and XX is going to become female, but because of the fact that a female only can pass on one kind of egg with respect to chromosomes, she does not determine the sex of the offspring. This is why the father in mammals determines the sex of every offspring. Because it's a coin flip for him. Hers is going to be an X. That's why both sexes have X in them. The other one, which is coming from the male, is going to be either a Y or an X. So he determines sex of offspring. Okay. The XY system that grasshoppers and some other insects use is, the X0 system, sorry, that the grasshoppers use. This is a 0, not an O, but it can be called XO system. Just zero makes it makes sense that it's a 0, though, because 0 indicates nothing. And in this system, in the X0 system, there is only one kind of sex chromosome, just the X. And what determines the sex is whether you have one or two of those X's. Okay, so XX's are females. X, and that's it, just one X, is males. So notice that means that for grasshoppers, males have one fewer entire chromosome than females do. And obviously that's not truly homologous, right? If there's not even another chromosome there. But that's the system they use. Then in a lot of birds, you have the so-called ZW system, a Z chromosome and a W chromosome. This is very, very similar to XY that we use, except in the opposite direction. So ZW is the female and ZZ is the male. And therefore, since it's the male that has two of the same chromosome, two Zs, he does not determine the offspring sex. She does, just the opposite for us, because she's the one that has two different chromosomes. Okay, but other than that, it works exactly the same, just in opposite direction compared to sex. The one that's to us seems most strange is the haplodiploid system used in social insects like bees. In the haplodiploid system, one thing that's strange to us is that there aren't any sex chromosomes at all. They're all autosomes, which is why you have just integers there, no symbols. It's 32 or 16. So there's male and female version of individuals, but there aren't sex chromosomes. What makes you a female in the haplodiploid system is that you're diploid. You have two of every chromosome. If you're given only one of each chromosome, then you're haploid and therefore male. So this brings up the other things that are kind of strange from our point of view. Notice that the only way you can be male is to be haploid. Well, how does this happen? Well, unlike most sexual species, species in the haplodiploid system have females that can have that can create eggs that can hatch without being fertilized. That's unlike us, right? A woman can make an egg and have it go unfertilized. That happens all the time. It's just that egg is going to die, right? It's not going to develop into a human. It's just going to end its life as an egg, just like most sperm in their life as a sperm. So she can have offspring without mating. If she does not mate, then all of her eggs will develop into, by definition, haploids, right? Because an egg is haploid. It was produced by meiosis. And then when it becomes multicellular as it develops, it stays haploid because mitosis does not change ploidy, right? And therefore, that bee will be haploid and it will be a male. So if she does not mate, she will have nothing but male offspring. If she does mate, then those eggs that become fertilized will be, by definition, diploid, right? Fertilization doubles the ploidy. And so those will all be females. And another strange twist to this is that notice that because of this, any given male does not have a father, right? He has to have been produced by just a female. and he cannot have any sons, right? Because if he mates, that will produce a diploid, which is a female. But despite not having a father and not being able to make sons, he has a grandfather, because a male was required to make his mother, and he can have grandsons, even though he can't have sons, right? Because his female daughter, his daughters can reproduce, can mate to produce males. Pretty cool, actually. All right, let's go to 6. These are just some more Punnett squares to look at, but in this case, we are looking at how things can work with respect to genetic disorders or heritable disorders. So, disorder, not only genetic, I shouldn't say just genetic, heritable disorders, because they're disorders that you either have or don't have depending on what genes you got from your parents. All right. The different shading here is used to indicate whether or not the person is affected, unaffected, or a carrier. There, remember, are three categories for this. This is back to autosomal stuff. So there's three categories of autosomal individuals, right? I mean, individuals when you care about an autosomal chromosome or an autosomal characteristic. What are the three categories?
Crossing over.
No, I'm talking about categories of individuals. In the normal autosomal case, characteristic is governed by an autosome, not a sex chromosome. What are the three categories of individuals? That's right. Any given individual is, yes, if you're talking about an autosome, that means every individual has two, right? We're talking about diploids. So there's only three categories, right? Three possible genotypes. Homozygous dominant, heterozygous, and homozygous recessive. Now, if we're talking about a heritable disorder that is caused by a recessive allele, which a lot are, that means, just like any other recessive allele, the only way that you actually have the disorder is if you're homozygous recessive, right? Because the dominant allele, which is the normal allele that doesn't cause the disorder, is enough to keep you from having it. But if you're a heterozygous individual, even though you don't have the disorder because of that one normal allele that you have, you're considered to be a carrier of the disorder, because you can pass on that mutant form that you have, since you're a heterozygous individual, and therefore you have the possibility of producing offspring with that genetic disorder. So the three shadings are, if it's white, that person is not only unaffected, but also totally normal. It's not even carrying the mutant gene. And so notice that we're looking at, actually, this one, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said autosomal before, because this is another sex-linked example. That's why we're using X's and Y's for yet another standard way of denoting the genotypes. By using X's and Y's, you can tell the sex of the individual, and then just using superscripts, you can say which allele they have for the gene that we care about. So N could stand for anything that acts this way, any genetic disorder that's caused by an X-linked gene. But capital N, that's the fully normal version, and that's what N probably stands for, and lowercase n is the allele that can cause the disorder. All right, so these aren't even all the possibilities, but just some possibilities. If you have a fully normal female, and remember, she has two of the alleles, he only has one, and an affected male, that's what the dark red means, then you would expect, however many children they have, you would expect all of the females to be carriers, and you'd expect all of the males to be completely normal males, right? And that's simply because the defective gene that he has the ability to pass on can never be passed on to his sons, right? Because it's on the X. If he passes on an X sperm, that's going to make a daughter, not a son. The Y that he has is normal. And so all of the daughters will have his defective gene, but the normal one that they got for the other X chromosome from the mother keeps all the daughters normal. They're just carriers. If a carrier female mates with a totally normal male in the middle, then you expect then you can have the possibility of having a child that is affected. And you'd expect one half of the sons to be affected. All of the females would be normal, but half of the females would be carriers. And then in the most severe of these three cases, which is not all the possibilities, is if you have a carrier female and an affected male mate, then you're going to have a 50% chance of the offspring in general being affected. Half of the females and half of the males. Half of the males will be totally normal. Half of the females will be normal phenotypically, but be carriers. And the other half of the overall brood, however many are created, will have the actual disorder. Okay, now on to seven. If you think about sex-linked genes, as we've been talking about, the reason, like I said, we call a male a hemizygote is because he has really only half as many alleles, one versus two, as the female does for that same gene, right? And think about molecularly what genes do. What are these genes doing, whether it's a male or a female? Indirectly, yeah. A gene is a set of instructions for how to build an RNA molecule, right? For the protein coding genes, which is what we've been talking about, that specific type of RNA is messenger RNA. That's transcription. And then messenger RNA goes on to be translated into a protein, a given polypeptide. And that polypeptide, whatever it is, gives that individual its trait that the allele corresponds to indirectly. So what this means in terms of sex-linked genes is that a homozygous female has twice as much coding, DNA code, for building the same protein as a hemizygous male does. If it's homozygous dominant versus hemizygous dominant male, he only has half as much DNA that can code for a given amount of messenger RNA in a given amount of time, right? She can produce twice as much mRNA, each of which can produce DNA. So she can, in the same amount of time, she has the capacity to build twice the amount of protein that he does. It would take him twice as long, or he can make only half as much in a given amount of time, right? So we say that they have different doses of DNA. There's a dosage difference in males and females only for sex chromosomes. For autosomes, they have equal dosages, right? They all have two alleles. Well, this could cause some problems, having different dosages in certain species. So many species have evolved a way to make up for that, to accomplish what we call dosage compensation. Certain species have dosage compensation mechanisms. And there's kind of two ways you could go about this in ones that use XY or something similar, where one sex has one chromosome and the other has two. One would be, since the female has a double dose compared to the male, one thing you could do is bring the male up to the level of the female somehow by basically having mechanism in place that allows him to transcribe better, more efficiently than she does. Right? That's going to, even though he only has half the alleles, if they're supercharged in a sense, they can bring him up to the level of her. Or you could bring the female down to the level of the male. And in mammals, not just this cat, but us as well, it's the latter way that occurs. Dosage compensation in mammals occurs by what we call X chromosome inactivation, which is exactly what the phrase says it is. One of the two X chromosomes that the female has gets inactivated during her development. Now, it's still there. It's still an X chromosome. It still has all those genes. But remember when we talked about how compact chromosomes get, or how the chromatin gets, and then you eventually start calling it a chromosome? Well, when it's really compact like that, supercoiled, it's easy to see as a distinct entity on the microscope, but it's impossible to transcribe those genes, right? It's just trying to not make a mess, a tangled mess, while it's moving these chromosomes around during meiosis and mitosis. But you can't use those genes. That's why during the normal lifetime of the cell, which is interphase, it's loose. The chromatin is loose so that you can get in there and read those genes and use those codes to make proteins. So one way, this X chromosome inactivation chooses one of the two X chromosomes and does the same thing, coils it so much that it can't be used, you can't use any of those genes. It's still there, it's just useless as far as genetic material is concerned. Okay, now, if you're considering if you have a homozygous female, and it wouldn't matter whether she's homozygous dominant or homozygous recessive, if she's homozygous, both of her alleles are the same, right? So it doesn't matter which of the two X chromosomes you inactivate, they're alike. So the one that you have is definitely going to be the same in all of your cells, right? This X chromosome inactivation does not happen at the zygote stage. If it happened in the zygote stage, then all of the cells that become the multicellular body of the individual would have the same X chromosome inactivated. But it happens after the zygote stage. It happens at the embryonic stage when it's already multicellular. It's not as big as it's going to be, but she's multicellular already as an early embryo. Okay? And therefore, however many cells she's made up of, each of those cells has two X chromosomes. Now, if she's homozygous, each of the cells has two identical X chromosomes, with not strictly speaking identical, but with respect to the one characteristic we're talking about, they would be identical. So it doesn't matter which one would get inactivated, right? They would all have the same allele operating in them, all those cells. And therefore, her entire body, once she develops completely, would have the same allele expressed in all of her cells. Does that make sense? On the other hand, if she starts out life as a heterozygous zygote, then she has two different kinds of X chromosomes, right? And if you copy those to make it an early embryo, that means it's going to matter which one gets randomly chosen at the embryo stage. Okay? So you're going to inactivate the dominant one in some cells and the recessive one in other cells. Once that inactivation happens in the early embryonic stage, it's set. And the cells that split into two cells by mitosis to become part of the body will pass that inactive one on. So it's in the two daughter cells that get created, it's the same X chromosome that's inactivated in them as it was originally. So, what this means is that heterozygous females are what we call mosaics. genetic mosaics where part of her body will have one allele expressed and other parts of her body will have another allele expressed because the other one has been turned off, right? And that's how you can have a multicolored cat, which are females. Because a male has only one allele, right? He's not undergoing any X chromosome inactivation because the whole reason that you have X chromosome inactivation is to bring the female down to the level of the male. So all, you know, he has just his X, that the only X he ever had, that's expressed in all of his cells. It's the same trait. Now think about this early embryo, just a glob of cells originally, for a female now, heterozygous female. If this one chooses the dominant one and this one chooses the recessive one to inactivate, then this one's going to produce two dominant cells. This one's going to produce two recessive cells, right? And these are going to keep that dominance, so they're going to each split into two more dominants. And so the part of the body that corresponds to the position of this cell in the embryo is going to have that dominant trait, and right next to it, there will be a collection of cells that will express the other trait. In this case, different colors of hair.
So you can actually see on the phenotype where like the color change started and stopped.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It is. And there are actually human mosaics as well. Not for fur color, but for the ability to sweat. It's possible for there to be a heterozygous female that has patches of skin that sweat easily right next to patches of skin that don't sweat. And you can't tell by looking at her. In fact, if she's sweating, you can't even tell it because it'll all drip into, it'll look like you're sweating normally. But if you got in there and looked at it on a duct-by-duct basis, sweat gland-by-sweat gland basis, some of them would be sweating and some of them wouldn't. Yeah. No, that's not X chromosome inactivation because, for one thing, that happens in males. I actually don't know the mechanism. I have to think about that. In a sense, you might say, well, why is it? What is it that makes them both be the same to begin with? Because you'd expect that it would be more likely that they're just independent things, right? They're two different organs, really. And there should be just as much chance of them being different as they are the same. But that's not what happens, obviously. It's the body does something to keep them the same. I don't know. I'd have to look into that. It's a good question, though. This all makes sense, though, this X chromosome inactivation? It makes the female equal in terms of dosage to the male. Okay, let's go to 8 then. Once again, we're looking at flies, but not their eye color anymore. There are two characteristics that we're tracking in this cross. What are the characteristics? White and black aren't characteristics. What are white and black?
Traits.
They are traits, not characteristics. I'm asking for the characteristics. There's two. Body color is one and wing shape is the other. Yes. And so this is a dihybrid cross. Two different characteristics, each of which has two traits, right? So the body color characteristic has black and gray traits, and the wing shape characteristic has full normal wings and what we call vestigial wings, which are very much reduced in size. And so notice that being a dihybrid, the two parents differ in both of the characteristics. Differ in the traits for both of these two characteristics. So she is a doubly homozygous dominant, because the dominant body color is gray and the dominant wing shape is normal full wing, and she has both of those. He is a doubly homozygous recessive individual, a double mutant. Remember that we call wild type the type that are found most often in nature. That doesn't have to be the dominant type, by the way. Wild type does not have to be dominant. It just often is. In this case, it is. He's a double mutant, though, because he differs. He has a mutant version of alleles for both of those two characteristics, for both genes. So look at the genotypes here. This is kind of like the same that we looked at for the sex-linked symbology. The B here stands for... Actually, it's not that way. It is. Yeah, the B stands for black, stands for the recessive. But if you have a plus superscript, it means you're not actually the recessive. You're the dominant type. So B plus means gray. VG, which stands for vestigial, is only vestigial version if it's VG by itself. VG plus means full-winged. So she is, like I said, doubly homozygous dominant. He is doubly homozygous recessive. Now, as you would expect for a normal autosomal dihybrid cross, 100% of the F1s should be double dominants, right? They should all be dominant in both the color, body color characteristic, and the wing shape characteristic. And they are. Okay? 100% of them would look like this one that's a female, but all of them would look like that, right? Because they're all heterozygous. Now we have a different kind of test cross occurring here. We're doing it for a different reason. But what we're doing is taking females from that F1, and instead of mating them with their brothers like you would in a normal F1, we're mating them with ones that are just like the original father, a double homozygous recessive mutant. Okay? And that leads to this Punnett square that we see. It has only one row for the same reason the other ones had only one row that we looked at. Because he, the male, can make only one kind of sperm. He's double homozygous recessive, right? And therefore, doesn't matter which sperm you choose, it's going to be a black version for the flower for the body color, and it's going to be the vestigial version for the wing shape. She, on the other hand, meaning the female from the F1, is a heterozygous individual. Therefore, there are four different possible eggs she can make. You can randomly pick a body color, and you can randomly pick a wing shape. So it's B plus VG plus, BVG, B plus VG, and BVG plus. Four. Those are the only four possibilities. So remember that Punnett squares really give you predictions. It says if you actually went through with this cross, this is the ratio you would expect. However many offspring are produced, you would expect one quarter of them to be each type. A 1:1:1:1 ratio, as you see in this row. That's the prediction, right? And remember that there are two categories here. What are the two? There's four overall kinds of individuals with respect to phenotype. But what are the two categories? This one, which is gray-bodied and full-winged, and this one, which is black-bodied and vestigial-winged, make up one category. What's that one category? What's different about them as one category compared to the other two? In a sense, but not truly. Right, that's the one category. Remember, there are parental types. Any type that's like either of the original parents is a parental type. These two are parentals. And then what are the other categories? The other category includes all individuals that aren't like either parent. What are those called? No? Right. They got that way because their alleles have been recombined compared to how they were in the parents, right? And so they are the recombinant types. You have parentals and recombinants. But the Punnett square says that you would expect a 1:1:1:1 ratio because of what Mendelian law? Describing something that happens in meiosis. What is it that explains why you'd expect the possibility of recombinance? In other words, how is it that the gray gene from the female can go a different way compared to the wing-shaped gene? How can they end up being in different gametes? Which is why she's able to make all four possibilities. Remember the analogy I used about alleles moving around? What did I say they are like? Passengers on a ship, right? All the passengers on a ship go the same place, whether they want to or not, right? But if you are two passengers on different ships, you're going to end up going on different places, right? Well, the ships are the chromosomes. The passengers are the alleles. What explains why you can have chromosomes, which are the ships, going in different directions? What is it? No. Remember I said that this is explained by one of the Mendelian laws. What are the two laws that we talked about?
Segregation.
Right. Law of segregation. And law of independent assortment. Yes. It's independent assortment that allows ships to go opposite directions, right? Because you're flipping a coin for that one tetrad, that one type of chromosome. You're flipping a different coin for each of the other ships, the other tetrads. All right? Okay. So, given that these two genes are on different chromosomes, if we're assuming that, then you would expect a 1:1:1:1 ratio. That doesn't have to be the case that they're on different chromosomes, though, right? These two different genes, one for body color, one for wing shape, could actually be riding on the same ship. They could be on the same chromosome. And therefore, you wouldn't expect any recombinant types to be possible, right? Because body color and wing shape are going to go together if they're on the same chromosome. So you'd expect her to only be able to make parental type eggs. Right? And not recombinant types. And therefore, if the two genes are on the same chromosome, then the ratio you'd predict is not 1:1:1:1, but 1:1:0:0. Because the recombinant types would be impossible. Is that all clear? I mean, is it actually clear, or are you just saying it is clear? This brings up another definition, by the way. And I don't want you to confuse it with sex-linked, which is one definition I gave you. Sex-linked describes a single gene. Right, a gene is either sex-linked or it's not. If it's not, it's autosomal because it's on an autosome. If it's sex-linked, we call it that because it's on a sex chromosome. That applies to just a single gene, right? Here, though, we're talking about the relationship of two genes, not just one. And if it is the case that those two different genes controlling different characteristics are on the same chromosome, then we call that pair of genes linked. Doesn't make sense to talk about a single gene being linked, right? Linked genes are linked because they're on, both of them are on the same chromosome. So you have to be talking about two genes when you're talking about linkedness. Whereas if you're talking about X-linkedness or sex-linkedness, one gene is what you're talking about. Is that all clear? Okay. So here you have the two ratios corresponding to the two possibilities. If these are different genes, they're either linked or they aren't. Right? And if they are linked, then you would expect no recombinant types, only parental types, 1 to 1 to 0 to 0. If they're not linked, then because of independent assortment, there should be an equal chance of all four. That explains the math of the predictions. Look at the bottom line, though, which is the actual results. When you do go through with this, neither one of these predictions comes true. And keep in mind that these two predictions correspond to the two possibilities. One of them must be true. They're either linked or they're not linked. The results, though, came back 965 to 944 to 206 to 185. So it's not 1 to 1 to 1 to 1 because these ones that are around 200 are much smaller than the ones that are around 1,000. But it's also obviously not 1 to 1 to 0, 0 because you made some recombinant types. So what is it that can explain this? How can you have recombinant types if you have linked genes? These genes appear to be linked, right? Because if they were unlinked, these would all be about the same number. The fact that you have a hell of a lot more parental types than recombinant types means that they must be on the same chromosome. Otherwise, they would be working independently and you would have 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. So this hints at them being linked. But how, if they are linked, can you have any recombinant types? What can happen that can explain this? That happens in all cases, but that doesn't explain how you can have recombinants. Now think about what this means in terms of this ship analogy. They're on the same chromosome by definition of being linked, right? You would expect them to both go in the same place because the chromosome is what moves, not individual alleles. But how can it end up that they actually get separated from each other and go different places? What is it that must have occurred if that happens? Yes. Think about what crossing over is, right? You have... I'm going to draw the two. These are non-sister chromatids. Okay? You really have two sister chromatids here and two sister chromatids here, but only one of them from each homolog is going to be involved in crossing over, right? So let's say that this is the body color gene and this is the wing-shaped gene. You have the same ones on the other side, even though they're not the same alleles, right? The same genes. If crossing over happens anywhere between those two loci, if crossing over happens right here, then this chromosome is going to carry this wing-shaped gene, but the body color gene from the other one, because they're going to swap, remember. That's what happens in crossing over. They not only cross over, but they trade the part of the chromosome downstream of that chiasma or crossover point. So the one chromosome is really going to be this, and the other one would be this. And you see now that the two linked genes, the two alleles of that of those two linked genes have been separated because of crossing over. Okay, does that make sense? That's how you can have recombinant types. Now, why would you have so few recombinant types? Depends on how likely it is for a chiasma or crossover point to occur between the two. Notice that if it occurs up here, they swap these tips, it's not going to matter. You're still going to have these two alleles go the same place, just like there's no crossing over happen. Or down here anywhere. Crossing over down here won't affect anything either. It's only if crossing over happens between the two loci will they be separated and go to opposite cells. So, it's all a probability. And slide 9 shows you what a grad student figured out a long time ago. Way before we could actually look at the DNA. Nowadays, it's routine to just sample someone's DNA and you know the entire sequence. Before, you couldn't do that. So what this grad student figured out is that if you know that you have linked genes, meaning they're on the same chromosome, then by looking at the offspring and calculating ratios of recombinants versus parental types, that should correspond to a distance apart that the two linked genes are. Because if we go back to, if we have an example of the two chromosomes, the same type of chromosome, but the two homologs, and the two different genes are on basically at opposite ends, then almost every crossover event is going to split them. Or you could have no crossover, which will keep them together, right? So the farther apart they are, the more likely it is for a recombinant type to occur. The maximum is 50%, just like it is for unlinked genes, right? They can go together just randomly, or they can go different ways randomly. Well, it approaches 50% even for linked genes the farther apart they get. And this is what the grad student figured out. So we have these, the Punnett square on the bottom showing the four types that we just talked about, the two parental types, the two recombinant types. And for each of these, you can calculate a recombination frequency. That's what he did, which is simply counting how many recombinants there are, dividing that by the total number of offspring. If you express it as a percentage, it simply means the percentage of recombinants. If that's really low, then that means, well, these two gene loci must be really close together, because that makes crossing over between them less likely. And so he figured out that by looking at these offspring, you can actually tell that not only are these two genes linked, but you know how linked they are, how close together they are. And if you spend a lot of work and do it a pair of genes at a time that you know are linked on the same chromosome, then by looking at these frequencies, you can get an idea of where the genes are. You can map them, in other words, like we see in slide 10. So this is way before the days in which you can look at the DNA sequence and map it that way. This was never even looking at molecules. This is just based on looking at the offspring. You can say not only are these three genes all on the same chromosome, but because of the frequencies of recombination that I get, these two must be on the ends and this one in the middle. Because the recombination between this B and CN is much less than B and BG. Right? The higher the recombination frequency, the more room you have between them, and therefore the more possibilities there are for a chiasma to randomly form between them, splitting them apart. All right, let's stop there. Till Wednesday.